Welcome to Portraits of the Blue and Gray, the Biographical Civil War Podcast, Episode 1, Robert E. Lee, Part 2. In April 1861, Robert E. Lee must have thought that his world was falling apart. The U.S. Army had been his career and the focus of his life for over 30 years. Now the Union he had served was breaking up, much to his personal disappointment, and he was forced to choose between taking up arms against his beloved home state of Virginia and fighting against the military that had been his career. Other Virginians had stayed loyal, including members of Lee's family. Lee's friend and former mentor in Mexico, Winfield Scott, had said, quote, "So long as God permits me to live, I will defend that flag with my sword, even if my own native state assails it," unquote. And of course, the flag Scott was referring to was the Stars and Stripes. Scott also responded to secessionist threats against newly elected President Abraham Lincoln with a threat of his own, saying, quote, "I'll blow them to hell," unquote. Yet when the cards were down, Lee stayed with Virginia. He didn't care much for politics and doesn't seem to have been overly fond of politicians. He had technically been a slave owner due to his wife's inheritance from her father, which was similar to the situation that U.S. Grant had found himself in. But he doesn't seem to have been much of a fan of the practice, and after the war he would say that he was glad to see it abolished. But the politicians had started a war, and so Lee would fight for his state. Lincoln emphasized that the war would not be about slavery. It was about preserving the Union. He tried to calm the Southerners by saying he had no intention of abolishing slavery in the South. He just didn't want to see it spread. But the Southern politicians were convinced that their peculiar institution was under attack, and with it, the entire economic system of the South. The cooler heads that had previously prevailed were nowhere to be found. Henry Clay had died in 1852, and Stephen Douglas was about to follow him. And so, the war began. Welcome to Portraits of the Blue and Gray, the Biographical Civil War Podcast. This is part two of our first episode, A Portrait of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. In part one, we looked at Lee's family history, childhood, and education, along with his early military career, including action in the Mexican-American War, and his decision to fight for the Confederacy. In part two, we'll take a look at Lee's initial assignments as a Confederate general and see him named as commander of the main rebel force in the Eastern Theater. We'll examine some of the battles that made Lee's name famous throughout the world and his bold decision to invade the North for the first time. So sit back, relax, grab some hardtack, and I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for listening. Lee didn't start the war as the heroic commander of the Army of Northern Virginia. His first field assignment was in areas now located in West Virginia, in Randolph and Pocahontas counties. Lee was assigned to coordinate the Confederate forces in the area, while Brigadier General William Loring retained direct command over the troops. Lee's plan was for a September 12, 1861 attack against Union forces at Cheat Mountain. The attack was unsuccessful, and Lee was largely blamed for the setback. Though faulty intelligence and poor execution by his officers were probably more of a factor than bad planning, Lee's attack plan was complicated and required more coordination than what could realistically be expected from green troops so early in the fighting. Despite the bad press he received, Lee admirably refused to make excuses or try to assign blame for the loss to anyone else, and he remained in the good graces of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Davis was a fellow West Pointer and Mexican War vet who had shifted to politics. He'd been a senator from Mississippi and Secretary of War before secession. He was known to be an ambitious, even ruthless political maneuverer, but he also had a reputation for being unwaveringly loyal to his friends. After his recall to Richmond in October, Lee was sent south to organize the coastal defenses in Georgia and the Carolinas as commander of the Department of South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Superior Union naval and artillery power led to the loss of Fort Pulaski in April 1862, following a three-month siege. The fort was part of the defenses of Savannah Harbor that Lee had helped construct during his time in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Despite the loss of Pulaski, the Confederates were able to block the federal advance on Savannah, and that city would hold out until taken by Sherman in 1864. Lee received more bad press for losing Fort Pulaski, though he can't really be blamed for the fort's loss. The Union naval guns and artillery simply overwhelmed the comparatively meager resources Lee could bring to bear. Short of a Tyrion Lannister at the Blackwater level surprise, the fort was going to fall, and Lee did not have any wildfire in his arsenal. Again, despite the bad press, Jefferson Davis stuck by Lee, appointing Lee as his senior military advisor and recalling him to Richmond. While in Richmond with Davis, Lee oversaw the preparation of the capital city's defenses. "Richmond must not be given up. It shall not be given up," Lee said emphatically. But his strategy for the city's defense was not to the men's liking, and he earned the derisive nickname King of Spades due to the number of trenches dug around the capital on his orders. It was around that same time that Lee ordered General Thomas J. Jackson, already known as Stonewall, to take action in the Shenandoah Valley. Jackson's famous Valley Campaign relieved pressure off of Richmond by causing President Lincoln to order General Irving McDowell, who had been approaching Richmond from the north, to march back to address the threat presented by Jackson. This allowed the Confederate Army defending Richmond, which was then under General Joseph Johnston, to focus on the threat posed by Union General George McClellan as his Army of the Potomac marched toward Richmond from the southeast in his Peninsula Campaign. McClellan had been largely unimpeded in his advance. Then, on May 31st, Johnston ordered an assault on McClellan's army, which had reached within a few miles of Richmond after landing at Fort Monroe, seizing Norfolk, and marching up the Virginia Peninsula. Though both sides sustained heavy casualties and the fighting represented the largest engagement in the Eastern Theater up to the point, the Battle of Seven Pines was tactically a draw. The most significant result of the battle was the wounding of Joseph Johnston, leaving him unable to retain command. General G.W. Smith, who was a personal friend of Johnston's, was the second-ranking officer, and therefore temporarily took the lead of the army defending Richmond. Davis and Lee had arrived from Richmond to observe the condition of the army after the battle and requested an interview with Smith. They found Smith utterly overwhelmed by the pressure of his circumstances. He had otherwise shown himself to be a capable officer, but overall command was beyond his abilities. Davis and Lee had no intention of allowing the defenses of Richmond to succumb to the Peter Principle. Davis therefore decided that Lee himself should assume command, and he did so in early June. Lee would enjoy an advantage over his predecessor Johnston. He held Davis's confidence. That was also an advantage that Lee enjoyed over McClellan, who was constantly second-guessed by the politicians in Washington, sometimes fairly, sometimes not. As expected, the Southern press loudly disagreed with Davis's decision to give Lee command. Lee, this time like McClellan, had a reputation for being overly cautious. His men referred to him as Granny Lee. That perception would come to change, but not at first. Upon assuming command, Lee put the troops to work digging trenches. The men complained. They thought digging in was an unmanly way of fighting and was no way to drive the Union troops out of the South. Nonetheless, they created an elaborate system of earthworks to prepare for McClellan's inevitable assault on Richmond, which was expected at any time. But the early June rain had turned the Virginia roads to mud. McClellan couldn't move his artillery, and his cautious nature wouldn't allow him to advance without it. Lee was glad for the delay, but he ultimately concluded that he'd have to bring the fight to McClellan before the latter could get his artillery into position to turn the battle into a siege. Lee hoped that, by digging in so thoroughly, a limited force would be able to defend Richmond, freeing up troops to attack. At that point, Lee had about 61,000 men at his disposal against over 100,000 Union soldiers. He called in what reinforcements he could muster and sent for Jackson to return from the Shenandoah Valley. He calculated this would bring his numbers closer to 86,000. That would be an impressive force, but McClellan thought Lee had 200,000. This was due to inaccurate reports from the Pinkerton men charged with providing the Union officers with intelligence and clever theatrics on the Confederate right orchestrated by General Prince John Magruder. Lee wanted to figure out what McClellan was up to, so he sent Cavalry Commander Jeb Stuart, who had been with Lee at Harper's Ferry, on a reconnaissance expedition around the Union lines. Stuart managed to circle fully around McClellan's army, pursued along the way by Union cavalry commanded by his father-in-law. In addition to taking 170 prisoners and capturing 300 horses and mules, Stuart gathered useful intelligence. First, the roads were still in bad shape, so McClellan was still moving slowly. But more importantly, the Union right flank was exposed. McClellan's position straddled the Chickahominy River. His right flank, to the north of the river, was unprotected. Lee's plan was to use Jackson's force, which was still in transit from the valley, to attack from the north. General A.P. Hill would then cross the Chickahominy and attack the southernmost part of the Union right. Next, Generals D.H. Hill and Longstreet would cross and advance through the Union positions that had, hopefully, been abandoned due to the flanking attacks. All four would then form up for an all-out attack on the center. This offensive was scheduled for June 26th, the earliest Jackson's men would be available. Now, to his credit, McClellan saw the danger on his right, but had been ordered by Secretary of War Edwin Stanton to keep his flank where it was, so as to eventually join up with General Irving McDowell, whose divisions were on the way to reinforce McClellan. Even more, a Confederate deserter warned McClellan that Jackson was on the move, preparing for an attack on his flank. Hoping to preempt Lee, McClellan ordered an attack from his left on the rebel right, south of the Chickahominy. The fighting was fierce, but the assault was repulsed and not renewed. Yet, the Confederate right remained vulnerable, and with it, Richmond itself. Still, McClellan chose not to press the issue. "No one but McClellan could have hesitated to attack," General Prince John Magruder remarked. The Union advance made Lee suspicious. He feared McClellan was aware of the upcoming assault, which he seems to have been. Nevertheless, the plan would proceed as scheduled. But things did not go according to the plan. Jackson was endlessly delayed by bad roads, Union cavalry, and worn-out men. The seemingly endless delay led Lee to worry that Jackson had been intercepted en route. Growing impatient, A.P. Hill crossed the Chickahominy and attacked anyway. The assault was easily repulsed in a lopsided affair. 1,350 Confederate casualties versus 361 Union. At one point during the day's fighting, Lee had to shoo away Jefferson Davis and quite a few other Richmond politicians who had wanted to observe how the battle was progressing and had positioned themselves within the range of the Union artillery. Lee reportedly asked Davis what army it was that Davis had brought with him. When Davis replied that it was not an army at all, Lee responded that it was not part of his army either, and therefore did not belong on the battlefield. The politicians got the hint and promptly returned to the rear. Lee had lost the element of surprise, and the troop movement had left his right vulnerable. McClellan, who again thought Lee's army significantly outnumbered his own, failed to take advantage of the vulnerability. Instead, he withdrew his right and began positioning for retreat, which he referred to as a change of base. Moving his base back to the James River would allow for the protection of Union gunboats, but not for the original plan of taking Richmond by siege, because Union siege guns could only travel by rail, and there was no railroad access at the James River base. The next day, Lee ordered another attack with a similar plan. D.H. Hill was to reinforce Jackson's flank attack, while A.P. Hill attacked the center, and Longstreet feigned an attack on the right. Again, the attack was poorly coordinated and delayed. The Confederates took heavy casualties but managed to force a hole in the Union center, necessitating a hasty withdrawal. Lee reported afterwards that, quote, "under ordinary circumstances, the Federal Army should have been destroyed," unquote. Lee made several unsuccessful attempts to stop the withdrawing Union forces from reaching the safety of their gunboats, but ultimately he gave up on the pursuit, and the Bluecoats reached the James River. To his credit, McClellan did execute a masterful retreat. His men managed to dish out significant damage to the Confederates in rearguard fighting, but their commander had surrendered the initiative to Lee, who seems to have gotten into his head. McClellan's high-ranking officers objected to the withdrawal, believing a counterattack was appropriate, and McClellan himself knew that he would take a hit politically and in the media as a result of his reluctance. After the fighting on June 27th, McClellan sent a telegraph to Secretary of War Edwin Stanton in Washington, quote, "I have lost this battle because my force was too small. The government has not sustained this army. If I save this army now, I tell you plainly that I owe no thanks to you or to any other persons in Washington. You have done your best to sacrifice this army," unquote. It seems that the colonel who initially received the telegram, perhaps not wanting to see McClellan immediately relieved of command, edited out the final two sentences before providing the note to Stanton. Again, at all times during the campaign, the Union force had the defending Confederate force outmanned and outgunned and was better supplied. Yet McClellan was convinced that he led the inferior force. Lee's army had taken heavy casualties, but the victory certainly did not leave them undersupplied. Along with the 10,000 Union prisoners taken during the 7 days' battle, they managed to capture 52 artillery pieces and some 35,000 stands of small arms. More importantly, he had managed to shift the fighting away from Richmond. The next major engagement would be closer to the northern capital than to the southern. Lincoln was growing frustrated with McClellan's reticence to fight. "If General McClellan did not want to use the army," Lincoln had said, only partly in jest, "I would like to borrow it." But instead of borrowing McClellan's army, Lincoln determined to form a second army for the Eastern Theater. This new force would be called the Army of Virginia and be commanded by General John Pope, who had seen some recent success out west. Lincoln had been impressed by Pope's swagger and his willingness to trade punches with his opponents. Upon coming east, the Kentuckian Pope announced to his army that, quote, "I have come to you from the west, where we have always seen the backs of our enemies, from an army whose business it has been to seek the adversary and to beat him when he was found," unquote. There would be no more talk of withdrawal or lines of retreat. "Success and glory are in the advance," Pope had said. McClellan was not so nearly impressed as Lincoln. He wrote to his wife Ellen, yes, Ellen McClellan, about Pope, quote, "The Pope bubble is likely to be suddenly collapsed," unquote. He described Pope as a paltry young man who wanted to teach me the art of war, and predicted that, upon encountering Lee, Pope would find himself in full retreat or badly whipped. The initial plan was for the new army to act in tandem with McClellan's army to squeeze Lee and Richmond in a vise. That never really came to fruition, and it ended up that McClellan would be ordered to withdraw from the Virginia Peninsula and reinforce Pope. But he did take his sweet time. Lee had taken McClellan's measure at the 7 days. He was confident that there wouldn't be another advance on Richmond anytime soon, so he decided to take out Pope's new army before it could join with McClellan's veterans. Unlike most of the Union generals that Lee had fought against, Pope inspired a personal loathing in Lee. Regarding Lewis Marshall, who was Lee's nephew and also a Virginian, but who had remained in the Union army, Lee said, quote, "I could forgive his fighting against us if he had not joined such a miscreant as Pope," unquote. This animosity arose primarily from orders issued by the general, which allowed for confiscation of private property belonging to anyone involved with the Confederacy, and for the execution of captured guerrilla fighters, and for the removal from occupied territory of any non-combatants who refused to take an oath of loyalty to the United States. By contrast, McClellan had drafted a memo to Lincoln offering his unsolicited opinions as to how the war should be conducted. To McClellan, subjugation of the Southern people was not the purpose of the fighting. Neither confiscation of private property nor forced abolition should be considered for the time. It should be a war between armed forces, not upon the civil population. Total war was off the table. Now, for his part, when commanding his army in Union territory in 1863, Lee would take a position much more similar to McClellan's. His June 27, 1863 order, issued while the Army of Northern Virginia was in Pennsylvania, stated, quote, "The commanding general considers that no greater disgrace could befall the army, and through it, our whole people, than the perpetration of barbarous outrages on the innocent and defenseless, and the wanton destruction of private property that have marked the course of the enemy in our own country. We make war only upon armed men, and cannot take vengeance for the wrongs our people have suffered without lowering ourselves." Lee earnestly exhorts the troops to abstain, with most scrupulous care, from unnecessary or wanton injury to private property, unquote. Officers were directed to arrest and punish anyone found in violation of the order. Lee's order seems to have been effective. Colonel Freemantle, who was the British observer that we mentioned in Part 1, reported, quote, "I went into Chambersburg," which is a small city in southern Pennsylvania, "I went into Chambersburg again and witnessed the singularly good behavior of the troops towards the citizens. To anyone who has seen, as I have, the ravages of the northern troops in southern towns, this forbearance seems most commendable and surprising," unquote. Turning back now to a year earlier, Lee ordered Jackson and A.P. Hill to march north and confront, or at least occupy, Pope. The movement needed to be quick so that they could return to Richmond in time to help defend against an advance by McClellan, should that happen. And Jackson and his corps which she affectionately referred to as foot cavalry, had a reputation for speedy marches from their days in the Shenandoah Valley. But Jackson also had a reputation for being secretive and generally difficult for his subordinate officers to deal with. Lee wanted to nip any potential conflict between Jackson and Hill in the bud, and so he sent a letter to Jackson about Hill, who himself had a bit of a reputation for being easily provoked. Lee writes to Jackson, quote, A.P. Hill, you will, I think, find a good officer with whom you can consult. And by advising with your division commanders as to your movements, much trouble will be saved you in arranging details, as they can act more intelligently. Cache your troops as much as possible till you can strike your blow, and be prepared to return to me if necessary. I will endeavor to keep General McClellan quiet till it is over, if it is rapidly executed. Unquote. Lee was trying to respectfully suggest to Jackson that he would be better off if he communicated more with his subordinate officers. But Jackson wasn't the type to pick up on this kind of subtlety. So, despite Lee's letter, Jackson kept Hill in the dark, and Hill resented him for it. Jackson's being prepared to return to Lee's aid was important, because without Jackson, who took with him one-third of Lee's army, Lee was down to just 56,000 men. McClellan would have double that number should he be reinforced by General Ambrose Burnside, who was believed to be traveling to Virginia from North Carolina. Now, as it turns out, the Union plan was to shift the focus of fighting back to Northern Virginia. McClellan had proposed taking Richmond via Petersburg, but Lincoln and General Henry Halleck, who had assumed McClellan's former position as overall commander of all Union forces, did not like the plan. McClellan, again, thinking his 85,000 troops were greatly outnumbered by Lee's, which he still estimated at 200,000, again asked for more reinforcements. Upon receiving the request, and McClellan's greatly inflated estimate of Lee's numbers, and thinking that it was a mistake to have the Eastern armies separated if Lee's troops were as numerous as McClellan thought, the powers in Washington decided to recall McClellan and have his army unite with Pope's. On August 9th, at Cedar Mountain, a smaller Union group under General Nathaniel Banks, who was a former governor of Massachusetts and who Jackson had embarrassed in the Shenandoah Valley, managed to surprise Jackson. Stonewall had reportedly been taking a nap when the battle broke out, so the surprise nearly ended in a rout. Jackson's force rallied, due in no small part to the actions of A.P. Hill, and the Battle of Cedar Mountain turned into a Confederate victory. Banks was reinforced, so Jackson didn't pursue, withdrawing a day later and recrossing south of the Rapidan River back toward Lee. Jackson would go on to characterize Cedar Mountain as one of his greatest victories, but realistically, Hill probably deserves more of the credit. Jackson's withdrawal had left the Virginia Central Railroad unprotected, which was problematic, so Lee sent Longstreet north to reinforce him on August 13th. At this point, Lee became aware that McClellan's troops were being loaded on transport ships, which Lee had assumed meant that they were being sent north to join Pope, so Lee decided to head north himself. When he arrived, Jackson and Longstreet informed Lee that Pope had positioned his force within the east-pointing triangle where the Rapidan and Rappahannock rivers meet. Pope believed that having the rivers protecting both of his flanks meant that his army was protected. Lee viewed this as an opportunity to assault Pope and to destroy his army while he was stuck in a position from which he could not easily withdraw. Lee drew up a plan, but never got the chance to try it. The Confederate cavalry hadn't arrived yet, and apparently they didn't realize that their orders to rejoin the army were time-sensitive. So on the night of the 18th, Pope's army preemptively withdrew toward Culpeper on the other side of the Rappahannock, preventing the possible destruction. Lee said to Longstreet upon seeing the Union forces had escaped, quote, "General, we little thought the enemy would turn his back on us thus early in the campaign." Unquote. After the withdrawal, Lee sent Jeb Stuart and his tardy cavalry to reconnoiter behind Pope's rear. When he had originally been on his way north to join Lee, Stuart had been surprised by a Union detachment while sleeping on the porch of a country home along his route. Stuart was able to escape unscathed, but in his hurry, he had lost his trademark plumed hat, much to his disappointment. Now, on his mission behind Pope's lines, Stuart came across a former slave who, as he put it, was glad to be back amongst his own people and agreed to take Stuart to Pope's headquarters. Pope wasn't there when the raid occurred, but Stuart was able to acquire invaluable copies of Pope's orders and correspondence with General Halleck, along with a payroll chest with $350,000. Stewart's men also helped themselves to Pope's dress coat and hat, which had been left in his tent, and which were complete with the general's name stitched on them. After returning to Confederate lines, Stewart would send Pope a dispatch offering a prisoner exchange, Stewart's hat for Pope's coat. Sadly, the offer does not appear to have been considered. More importantly, the captured dispatches included the schedule for the Union plan to combine Pope's army with McClellan's. It appeared that Pope's army had already become too strong for a direct assault, having already begun to be reinforced. So rather than give up and return to the defenses of Richmond, Lee devised a risky maneuver with the goal of luring Pope into a trap. He would spurn conventional military thinking and divide his force. Jackson and A.P. Hill would march north around Pope's right flank and attempt to take the Union supply depot at Manassas Junction, which had been the scene of the First Battle of Manassas, while Longstreet held the position on the banks of the Rappahannock and tried to keep Pope's attention while Jackson marched around the rear. The idea was that Jackson would sneak around and wreak some havoc on the Union supply and communication lines to convince Pope to withdraw from the Rappahannock and chase him. Then the rest of the army would head north, reunite, and fight Pope while he was separated from his reinforcements to the south. Jackson's movement surprised Pope, and he acted as Lee had hoped. He withdrew from the defensive position along the Rappahannock River, and he moved to confront Jackson. Jackson's men by that point had reached the Union supply depot and were absolutely blown away by the Union stores. They ate their fill of pickled oysters, canned lobster, and real bread, and left with as much coffee and cigars as they could carry. Jackson did, probably wisely, make sure that all the whiskey was destroyed before the men could get to it. On a short side note, a train wreck had occurred where Jackson's men had destroyed the rail lines that were supplying Pope's army. A northern politician who had been traveling on the train to observe Pope's army had suffered a broken leg in the wreck and was speaking with some of Jackson's men. He was immobile due to the fracture and asked that the men pick him up so that he could get a good look at Jackson, who by that point had earned quite a reputation. Upon seeing the infamous stone wall, and presumably being unimpressed by the general's dirty, slouched appearance and tattered clothes, including the cadet cap that he still wore from his days as an instructor at VMI, rather than the fancier hats favored by most generals, the politician exclaimed, quote, "Oh my God, lay me down," unquote. After that, "Oh my God, lay me down," became a sort of an inside joke or catchphrase within the Stonewall Brigade for the duration of the war. In any situation where it could apply, someone would say, "Oh my God, lay me down," and they would all share a laugh. It reminds you of the sort of inside joke that a little league or high school baseball or football team might have, where it's not really all that funny on the surface, but somehow becomes funny because everyone's in on the joke. There are quite a few good stories about the Stonewall Brigade that we're going to have to get into when we do a future episode on Jackson. But back to our main timeline. After commandeering as much of the provisions as he could take with him and destroying the nearby railroad that had been supplying Pope's army, Jackson assumed a strong position at the site of the 1861 battle. Meanwhile, Lee ordered General James Longstreet to march north and join Jackson. Pope had hoped to defeat Jackson before he could be reinforced, and he assumed that Stonewall would retreat. Instead, the unorthodox Jackson ordered an attack on August 28th. The Stonewall Brigade, which was down to 635 men from the 3,000 it had started with, would be further reduced to 425 after the heavy fighting. Their opponent that day included a group of farm boys from Wisconsin and Indiana, then going by the nickname the Black Hat Brigade, due to the non-regulation black felt hats that their commanding officer had equipped them with. They were supposed to be untested green troops, but you couldn't tell by the way they brawled with the Stonewall Brigade, who were considered some of the hardest men in the Confederate Army. The Black Hat Brigade nickname didn't last long. Soon, they were the Iron Brigade, with a reputation as one of, if not the, fiercest fighting brigades in the Union Army. After their baptism by the Stonewall Brigade, the Iron Brigade would go on to sustain the highest percentage of casualties of any brigade in the war. Jackson had got Pope's attention, and again assumed a strong defensive position along a ridge, awaiting Pope's counterattack while counting on Longstreet's reinforcements. Pope didn't know about the plan to combine Jackson and Longstreet, and believed that he'd be able to bag Jackson while he was still significantly outnumbered. By this point, Jackson was positioned along an unfinished railroad that acted as an impromptu trench, and Longstreet, with Lee with him, were already on their way to join Stonewall. In fact, the two groups were now only about 20 miles apart, and they were close enough to find their way to Jackson's position by following the sounds of his artillery. The groups reunited, with Longstreet assuming a position at Jackson's right. Lee had also requested reinforcements from Richmond from Jefferson Davis. Davis responded with a cavalry brigade and 10 infantry brigades. Davis acknowledged that the further reduction in Richmond's defenses would bring him criticism, but expressed his faith in Lee. Quote, "Confidence in you overcomes the view which would otherwise be taken of the exposed condition of Richmond. The troops retained for the defense of the capital are surrendered to you on a new request." Unquote. The promised troops would bring the total available to Lee to 72,000. If you were going to be a Confederate general, it helped to be on Jefferson Davis's good side. Pope attacked Jackson on August 29th. Assaults came on both of Jackson's flanks. Wave after wave, charge after charge battered against Jackson's lines, but still the line held, but just barely. The attack failed from a combination of factors, including Jackson's strong position, ambiguous orders, which would lead to the court-martial of Corps Commander Major General Fitzjohn Porter, though that was eventually reversed by President Chester Arthur after the war, and Pope's underestimating the Confederate force due to his continued lack of knowledge as to Longstreet's presence. Still, Pope remained confident. He still believed that Jackson would attempt to retreat, despite all evidence to the contrary, including Stonewall's nickname itself, which should have suggested the Corps commander's psychology included a reluctance to retreat, and Pope remained unaware that he was facing the full combined strength of the Confederate Army. So, Pope ordered another attack on August 30th. It nearly succeeded, breaking the defending line at one point. For perhaps the only time in his career, Jackson requested reinforcements, fearing that he couldn't hold out much longer. Longstreet had set up an artillery battery of 18 guns in a position commanding the field where the Union troops were attacking, but he had yet to fire. He was waiting for just the right time when all of the Union reserves had been committed. Then, Longstreet received Jackson's request for help from Lee. Longstreet answered that he would send the requested division, but it wouldn't be necessary. His artillery would halt the attack. When the artillery barrage began, it slammed into the left flank of the attackers. They were disoriented from the sudden, unexpected outburst, and the attack faltered. The tides of battle had changed, and Lee unleashed an all-out counterassault. Both Jackson and Longstreet ordered rapid advances that drove the Union forces back all along the lines. One unfortunate New York regiment that took the brunt of the assault from Jackson's men lost 124 dead and 223 wounded out of 490. Now, despite the surprising, overwhelming advance and poor generalship from Pope, there was no rout as had happened at the First Battle of Manassas in the prior year. The Union troops were now disciplined professional soldiers, and they were able to avoid being overrun with effective rearguard fighting. At Second Manassas, Lee lost 9,197 casualties out of the 50,000 men engaged, compared to 16,054 casualties for Pope out of his 60,000 that engaged. The Union casualties included 5,958 missing, and there were also 7,000 prisoners taken, along with 30 captured artillery pieces. Lee did not achieve the decisive destruction of Pope's army that he had hoped for, but he had succeeded in gaining the momentum and smacking down the general he considered a miscreant. His men's morale had never been higher, and the officers were now coordinating with each other much better than during the 7 days. Where McClellan was threatening Richmond just a few months before, now Lee was in a position to threaten Washington. Pope tried to spin the battle as a victory to his bosses in D.C., but it didn't take Lincoln, Halleck, and Stanton long to realize that Pope's command of the Army of Virginia had been a miserable failure. As one of the Union Corps historians put it, Pope had been, quote, "kicked, cuffed, hustled about, knocked down, run over, and trodden upon as rarely happens in the history of war. His communications had been cut, his headquarters pillaged, a corps had marched into his rear and had encamped at its ease upon the railroad by which he received his supplies. He had been beaten or foiled in every attempt he had made to bag those defiant intruders, and in the end, he was glad to find a refuge in the entrenchments of Washington, whence he had sallied forth 6 weeks before, breathing out threatenings and slaughter." Unquote. It was decided that Pope's Army of Virginia would be merged with McClellan's Army of the Potomac. Prior to the battle, McClellan had found himself in the position of a commander essentially without an army, with most of his forces having been reassigned or slated for reassignment to Pope. Instead, McClellan was now once again commanding nearly all Union forces in the Eastern Theater. Pope, on the other hand, was relieved of command and sent northwest to Minnesota, where he would spend the rest of the war dealing with Sioux unrest. As a follow-up to his success at Second Manassas, Lee devised a plan to bring his army, now numbering about 55,000, across the Potomac River into Maryland. The crossing began on September 3, 1862. Lee hoped to replenish his supplies in fertile western Maryland, which remained mostly untouched by the war. And he hoped to influence the upcoming northern congressional elections in favor of the peace movement. Northern Virginia had been ravaged by hosting the two armies and could no longer be relied upon to supply Lee's force. Lee thought the Maryland population would welcome him and his army, and maybe even provide some new recruits. Maryland was a slave state and had been traditionally close to Virginia. Then, after replenishing in Maryland, he planned to cross the Mason-Dixon line into Pennsylvania and move on Harrisburg, taking out the B&O and Pennsylvania railroads in the process and cutting the Union East off from the Union West. It was hoped that a successful campaign into Union territory would also help garner foreign support. After Manassas, Lord Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, had written, quote, "The Federals got a very complete smashing. Even Washington or Baltimore may fall into the hands of the Confederates. If this should happen, would it not be time for us to consider whether in such a state of things, England and France might address the contending parties and recommend an arrangement on the basis of separation?" Unquote. Palmerston took a wait-and-see approach when he heard of Lee's incursion into Maryland, and would almost certainly have pressured Washington for peace had Lee been successful. Lee's men sang "Maryland, My Maryland" as they marched, in high spirits despite their ragged appearance. Turns out most of the pro-Confederacy sentiment they had heard about was in the eastern part of the state, specifically Baltimore. So support from the locals in western Maryland, where Lee invaded, was not forthcoming. Historian James McPherson identifies one citizen of Frederick, Maryland, describing the Southern Army as, quote, "the filthiest set of men and officers I ever saw, with clothing that had not been changed in weeks. They could be smelt all over the entire enclosure," unquote. Lee himself wasn't in his best shape at the time either. He was riding in an ambulance, having broken a bone in one hand and sprained the other a week earlier when he fell while trying to grab the bridle of a startled horse. At Jefferson Davis's insistence, Lee released an address to the people of Maryland. He appealed to Maryland as a sister state, allied to the states of the South by the strongest social, political, and commercial ties. Lee's men were not invading. They had come to aid Maryland in throwing off this foreign yoke. Now, despite their best efforts, the welcome mat was not rolled out, just as the Mexican population had not welcomed the U.S. forces when Lee had worn blue those many years ago. The Union forces, on the other hand, found the Western Marylanders most welcoming, with some describing the citizens of Frederick, Maryland in particular, as the most welcoming they encountered during the entire war. Lee's plan was to again go unconventional and divide his force. Three columns led by Jackson, representing two-thirds of the total army, would take the Union garrison at Harper's Ferry, manned by 12,000 men, and with which Lee was intimately familiar. They would then reunite with the other third for the march to Pennsylvania. Longstreet objected to the perilous plan to divide the army, while Jackson was thrilled, as might be expected. But one partition wasn't all. Jackson's contingent would also be divided and separated by the Potomac River, so as to allow for the occupation of the heights on three different sides of the garrison. Jackson would occupy Bolivar Heights, which is now in West Virginia. McLaws would hold Maryland Heights across the Potomac River from Harper's Ferry, while Walker would arrive from south of Harper's Ferry and occupy Loudoun Heights across the Shenandoah in Virginia. Longstreet would stay in Maryland near Boonesboro with D.H. Hill. Lee anticipated that Harper's Ferry would surrender within a day, indefensible as it is, and the divided army would reconverge 3 days later in Boonesboro, then proceed into Pennsylvania. The plan was risky. Even at full strength, McClellan significantly outnumbered Lee, but Lee figured he could count on McClellan's cautious nature to give him enough time to pull it off. When General Walker showed some concern with the audacity of Lee's plan, Lee reportedly said to Walker, quote, "Are you acquainted with General McClellan? He is an able general, but a very cautious one. His army is in a very demoralized and chaotic state and will not be prepared for offensive operations. Or he will not think so. For 3 or 4 weeks, before that time, I hope to be on the Susquehanna," unquote. The Susquehanna is a river that runs through central Pennsylvania by Harrisburg. Lee was wrong about the state of his opponent's army. Union morale surged upon McClellan's reassuming command. He was their leader, and they were glad to have him back. Manassas was on Pope, not a strike against them or their fighting ability, but Lee's psychological evaluation of McClellan would probably have been sufficient if not for an event that could not possibly have been foreseen. McClellan was able to learn of Lee's designs when two of his men came across a carelessly discarded copy of Lee's orders, which had been apparently left wrapped around three cigars by a Confederate staff officer and then was found by a few Union soldiers. It didn't take long for the soldiers to understand the importance of what they had found, bearing the name R.E. Lee as it did, and they quickly sent it up the chain of command. Upon his review of the fortuitously discovered order, McClellan reportedly said, quote, "Here is a paper with which, if I cannot whip Bobby Lee, I will be willing to go home," unquote. McClellan's men had discovered that Lee's forces were divided, with one of the divided halves closer to McClellan than to the other half. This was the kind of golden opportunity that only comes about once in a blue moon. So McClellan mobilized his army for an offensive much more quickly than nearly any of his prior movements. He planned to move through the South Mountain Pass and systematically attack the divided portions of Lee's army before they could reunite. However, a local Confederate sympathizer, having learned of McClellan's plan and that McClellan knew of Lee's plan, hastily sent word to Lee. Lee then in turn sent word to Jackson to return with all haste, which Jackson ultimately did, leaving only a small contingent under A.P. Hill to handle the Union surrender at Harper's Ferry. Lee was initially resigned to having to fall back across the Potomac River into Virginia to regroup. He'd have to give up on the invasion of Pennsylvania for the time and the taking of Harper's Ferry. But a dispatch from Jackson, which stated that Harper's Ferry would fall early the next day, thereby allowing Jackson to rejoin Lee, changed his mind. Instead, he would rally as much of the divided army as could be gathered in Sharpsburg and prepare for battle. In taking Harper's Ferry, which did in fact surrender early the next morning, Jackson captured 13,000 small arms, 73 cannon, and a good haul of much-needed supplies. He then brought five of his six divisions to join Lee, leaving A.P. Hill behind with one division to handle the surrender. McClellan did move quickly, but that was only by Little Mac standards, so he had waited for nearly a day before acting on Lee's plans, and he was further delayed at the Battle of South Mountain by fierce fighting from D.H. Hill's men. They had been sent there to hold the mountain pass in an attempt to block the Union crossing and protect the flank from an advance from the east. The defenders were heavily outnumbered and had little chance of victory. But that wasn't the objective. The objective was slowing McClellan down. Interestingly, two future presidents were among the Union troops fighting at South Mountain, William McKinley and Rutherford Hayes, who was wounded in the fighting. Both McKinley and Hayes served in the 23rd Ohio Infantry. McKinley, who was just 19 years old at the time, was a commissary sergeant, while Hayes was a 39-year-old lieutenant colonel in command of the regiment. By the end of the war, Hayes would be a brevet major general and McKinley a brevet major. Hayes was elected president 14 years later in 1876, and McKinley 24 years later in 1896. So McClellan didn't fully arrive to the area near Sharpsburg, Maryland until September 16th. He ordered some limited probing on the Confederate position on that date, but waited for the full attack until September 17th. This allowed Lee to better prepare his defensive position and also allowed for the majority of Jackson's group to reunite with Lee's. Had McClellan chose to attack on the 16th, Lee would have had only about 26,000 men to defend against McClellan's close to 80,000. The Confederate army was positioned along a hill line behind a shallow creek called Antietam, both flanks protected by the bending Potomac River. But having the river on the right was a two-edged sword. It kept the flank protected, but it allowed for only one effective retreat option back to Virginia, through a ford in Shepherdstown. Like Harper's Ferry, Shepherdstown is now in West Virginia. The college there, Shepherd College, actually now known as Shepherd University, which is your humble podcaster's alma mater, is now home to the George Tyler Moore Center for the Study of the Civil War. The Battle of Antietam, which occurred on September 17, 1862, was the bloodiest single-day battle in United States history. Almost 23,000 total casualties, out of around 37,000 engaged for the Confederates and 70,000 for the Union. Importantly, McClellan didn't commit all the men that he had available into fighting at the battle. McClellan's attack began on the Confederate left because the best bridge for crossing the Antietam was there. Lee anticipated that the attack would come on his left due to the prior night's probing and had reinforced his flank. The assault began when General Joseph Hooker's corps attacked the portion of the line commanded by Jackson. The fighting was very intense, characterized by back-and-forth charges and countercharges. The casualty rates were extremely high. Just when one side seemed to gain an advantage, reinforcements for the other would arrive and the tables would turn. At one point, Union General Bull Sumner ordered a tightly packed division to attack just as McLaws had arrived on Lee's orders to reinforce Jackson. As luck would have it, McLaws' men approached in a position to counterattack the attacking Union division's exposed flank. In about 15 minutes of fighting, the hapless Union division took over 2,200 casualties. Two entire Union corps, comprised of over 30,000 men, had been involved in the attack on the Confederate right. At the end of the fighting, they had gained a small amount of ground, but the line held, with heavy losses to both sides. Overall, the Union battle plan was poorly coordinated. McClellan had positioned his headquarters over 1 mile in the rear, and he ran into some difficulties communicating with his corps commanders. Had the various assaults been launched simultaneously, the Union forces may very well have completely overwhelmed the Confederates with their superior numbers. As it did proceed, Lee was able to take advantage of interior lines and redistribute forces as he needed, such as McLaws. The day's fighting occurred in three phases, sometimes described as three different battles within one greater battle. In the north in the morning on the Confederate left under Jackson, which we just discussed, in the center in the afternoon, and in the south in the evening on the Confederate right. In the center, D.H. Hill's men were greatly outnumbered, but held the advantage of a highly defensible position in a trench known as the Sunken Road, which would later become known as Bloody Lane. They were able to repel several infantry charges, dishing out heavy casualties with sheets of fire from their entrenched position, until a confusing order caused the men occupying the left side of the road to withdraw. They were able to repel several infantry charges, dishing out heavy casualties with sheets of fire from their entrenched position, until a confusing order caused the men occupying the left side of the road to withdraw. This allowed a Union contingent to move into the abandoned position and fire down into the sunken road. Now being picked apart from a superior firing position, the defenders, or what was left of them, were forced to withdraw, their trench having turned into a death trap. The retreat could easily have become a rout and an overall Union victory, but so many Union officers had been killed or injured during the fighting at Bloody Lane that nobody was able to organize an advance on the hole that had been created in the Confederate center, and the gap was eventually filled. McClellan was reportedly asked by some of his subordinates if he wanted to order a strike on the center, but he decided he didn't want to risk committing his last reserves. He was still convinced that Lee had many more men than what he actually had, and he wanted to be prepared to repel what he viewed as an inevitably coming counterattack. Now, Lee did consider launching a counterattack. It would have been against the Union left after the fighting in the center had died down. The assault was to be led by Jackson and comprised of the survivors of the morning's fighting. Jackson was reportedly excited about the prospect, but upon surveying the area, had to report to Lee that the Union position was too strong. Too many artillery pieces would command the approach. To both Lee's and Jackson's disappointment, the planned attack had to be abandoned. The fighting on the southern part of the lines occurred in the afternoon. Union General Ambrose Burnside's corps was able to capture a stone bridge that had been held throughout the day by a group of Georgians under Robert Toombs. Toombs had been the Confederacy's first Secretary of State before resigning to take a military command. The Confederate right had been reduced to the bare minimum to occupy the position, because most of the reinforcements sent to other areas had come from the right. But the Georgians' covered position overlooking the bridge had allowed them to rain fire down onto the potential crossers while being basically unhittable themselves. So they had been able to hold the bridge throughout most of the day with their limited numbers. In the evening, a combination of an assault on the bridge by overwhelming numbers and the discovery of a nearby passable ford allowed for an attack on the Confederate right. But by this point, the groups that had crossed successfully were nearly out of ammunition, leading to delay in following up on the success. When the attack began, it looked like it would succeed based on numbers alone. The Confederate right would be driven back and cut off from their best avenue of retreat. But help arrived in the nick of time in the form of A.P. Hill arriving from Harper's Ferry. He had marched at full speed all day upon receiving word that there would be a battle. Adding to the confusion caused by the sudden addition of new troops fighting on the right, many of Hill's men were now wearing blue uniforms, having helped themselves from the Union stores at Harper's Ferry to replace the rags they had been wearing. Hill's fresh force managed to drive Burnside back as the day's fighting drew to an end. Both commanders ordered their armies to prepare for battle the next day, but McClellan didn't think his army was in good enough shape for another attack on September 18th, and Lee had taken enough lumps that he didn't have much choice but to withdraw back across the Potomac, unsuccessful in his first incursion into Union territory. There was some limited skirmishing as Lee's army moved to cross at Shepherdstown, but no serious attempt to prevent the crossing. The battle was effectively a draw, but because the Confederates withdrew, it could be spun as a Union victory. In celebration of the victory, Lincoln announced the Emancipation Proclamation afterward. Lincoln had penned the proclamation a few months earlier, surprising his cabinet members because he had been unwilling to make the war about slavery up until that point for fear of alienating the border states. In a public letter addressed to abolitionist Horace Greeley, written just a few weeks earlier, Lincoln had said, quote, "If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free." Unquote. At the time Lincoln initially presented the proposed Emancipation Proclamation to his advisors, they had urged him to wait to issue it until after a victory, so that it wouldn't look like a desperate political ploy to rally support and prevent foreign intervention. After the release of the proclamation, for the first time, the war could reasonably be described as being for the official purpose of bringing an end to slavery, which would make British intervention much less feasible politically. The Army of Northern Virginia had been bloodied, but so had the Army of the Potomac. Lincoln was unhappy with McClellan's decision not to press the attack after Antietam and decided to remove McClellan from command. McClellan had been plagued by an overly cautious nature, political maneuverings by his enemies in Washington, and an inability to shake the belief that Lee had many more men in his army than he actually had. However, when asked after the war to identify the most capable Union commander he had fought against, Lee reportedly named McClellan without hesitating. McClellan had been instrumental in turning the Army of the Potomac into an effective fighting force, and there is no doubt that his men loved him and were deeply disappointed by his removal. But we will save those thoughts and some other interesting topics on McClellan for a future episode on Little Mac. Lincoln's chosen replacement was General Ambrose Burnside, who was a friend of McClellan's and who had fought under McClellan at Antietam and lent his name to one of the battle's better-known landmarks, Burnside's Bridge. Burnside somewhat reluctantly accepted command, having previously stated that he did not believe himself competent to command the entire Army of the Potomac. As events would play out, and as we shall see in Part 3 of our Portrait of Robert E. Lee, it would appear that Burnside, though capable in smaller commands, was correct in his self-assessment. And that will bring to an end Part 2 of our Portrait of Robert E. Lee. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll check out Part 3, where we're going to look at Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, and we'll see Lee finally meet his match in the form of Union General Ulysses S. Grant. I'm still not sure whether there will be a Part 4 to this series or not. That'll depend a lot in how much information we can get into Part 3. I don't want to make each individual show too long, and there's a lot of information about Lee after the war that I'd like to discuss. So we'll play it by ear, and thanks again for tuning in. If you would like to contact Portraits of Blue and Gray, you can reach us by email at blueandgraypodcast@gmail.com. Questions and comments are welcome from Yankees and Secesh alike. And remember, we always spell gray the old-fashioned way, G-R-E-Y. Visit the show's webpage at portraitsofblueandgray.podbean.com. If you enjoyed the show and want to contribute financially, click on the Become a Patron badge at the top of the main page to visit our crowdfunding page. Or visit that page directly at patron.podbean.com/blueandgray. All contributors are wholeheartedly appreciated and will be thanked by name in an upcoming episode, unless you ask us not to. Please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever other app you used to find us. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again soon.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.